This is episode 2 Charlie of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And this is the Software Freedom Law Show.
That's true, it is. I told you we should just do the thing they do on BSD Talk. We've never mentioned BSD Talk before.
Have we never?
I'm pretty sure we have not.
For our listeners, they may be interested to know that I like singing the song from that podcast, the theme song.
But his podcast is often just an interview or a speech, and he just comes on very briefly and says, I just have an interview for you today, here it is.
Well, we don't have an interview today.
But then we would say, we just have a recorded speech for you today. Here it is.
We have a recorded speech for you today.
But you actually want to say what it is.
Well, yeah, it's a speech that Eben Moghalen, our executive director, gave in Scotland, actually on the day that Bilski came down on the 30th, June 30th.
Bilski is really old news, though.
Bilski is old news.
It's all
but
over.
It was very anticlimactic.
We're going to have... Well, no, but just tell us we'll have software patents forever.
Well, we don't know that.
Well, I'm a pessimist.
So true. So true.
I'm just afraid that we're going to have a long time before there's any end to software patents.
I mean, I think that seems clear based on the decision. Actually, not much else seems clear from the decision. Anyway, so Eben's talk was called... When software isn't everything, future liability nightmares free software helps avoid.
And there's a colon in there somewhere, right?
Yeah, it's when software isn't everything, colon. Future liability nightmares free software helps avoid. And actually, I was actually going to maybe promise a transcript, but I'm not sure if we'll have one by then.
Okay.
But we may or may not have a transcript in our show notes.
Well, you know the thing about putting colons in titles about theses, right? So there's this thing a professor told me once, this history professor, that every time you write a PhD thesis or a master's thesis, for that matter, I guess, you try to avoid having a colon somewhere in the title, and then eventually you always do. This is really
not as exciting. Why do you avoid having a colon?
Well, because I think colons and titles are a bit, they make them longer and that sort of thing. I don't actually remember now that I think about it.
I think colons are advantageous in titles because they help keep it zippy.
Well, I was trying not to have a colon in my master's thesis title, and I did in the end. So it actually happened to me as well.
I think I have a colon in my OSCON talk title. Maybe I'll rename it.
Oh, you're the talk you're giving. You're giving a talk by yourself. Oh, that's right. You're giving your talk on. We should tell people that.
Oh yeah. Well,
because that's going to be the week later.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Actually, yeah. Both we're going to actually all three Ogcast SFLCers are going to be at OSCON. So it's because Bradley and I are both going to be there, and Aaron as well.
That's correct. And we're giving a talk together, just a really general introductory talk on legal issues for free software developers, what they should know about.
Yep. So just a basic intro. There's usually one every year at OSCON, so I'm pretty excited that we get to be the ones to do that one this year.
Well, it's probably because we finally actually proposed one.
That's
if we didn't propose
true.
That talk any other year, we can't really expect the OSCON organizers to accept a talk we didn't propose. So the moment we proposed it, they accepted it. And they also accepted your talk about the heart device issue.
That's right. So we're going to...
And that's the one that has the colon.
That's the one that has the colon. So our other talk doesn't have a colon. I can't remember.
I sure hope it doesn't.
Either title. If you keep talking for a second, I can tell you.
I don't know. Because if it does, I'll feel horrible now.
The titles in the talk will be in the show notes. I can promise that.
Yeah, and they're also on the OSCON schedule. If you're going to... At this point... people know whether they're going to be at OSCON or not by the time they hear this. So,
right.
Well, it's not like we're going to inspire people to come see us at OSCON.
That's true. I'm excited about the talk, though, because for our listeners, they've heard most of the major points from my other talk anyway in our medical devices episode.
And Aaron Williamson is speaking about something that we covered on the podcast with him as well. He's talking about mobile phones and software freedom with regard to mobile phones.
So the podcast listeners have the jump on all of the OSCON attendees.
Yeah, I mean, they probably actually heard the material. So if you feel bad that you couldn't get to OSCON, you've heard all our material, pretty much.
All the important material.
Yeah, well, okay.
I'm just kidding. So,
If we sound different, we should tell people why we sound different.
I know. It's pretty exciting. We're in a different location, and we have an on-location producer today.
It's true.
In addition to Producer Dan. Yeah.
Producer Dan is not able to be on location because he's in the United Kingdom and we're in the United States. But we have an on-site producer today volunteering his time kindly.
Very kindly.
To assist.
That was my computer. beeping. It's true, and you may know him as our podcast composer and musician instead.
That's true.
So anyway, Mike Tarantino has helped us with setting up in his local studio, so our sound might be a little bit different today.
It'd probably be better, because this is a pretty hardcore mic.
We look really official. It's really cool.
Yeah, this mic is probably, like, really expensive, too.
It has this really awesome retro look to it, too.
Yeah, I don't want to fall over on it. We're standing up, too, because the mic's like one of these standing on its one of these mic stands. We didn't have a mic stand.
No, and we've got headphones, too.
Yeah, I'm still learning this headphone thing. I notice all other, like, official-looking podcasters wear headphones.
So we're at least official-looking today. Anyway, we should probably let people get to the speech, because I think it's at least an hour long, so...
This is why I wanted to do the BSD talk thing.
Fair enough. Enjoy.
We just
Evan's
have a speech
talk
for you today, and here it is.
We're very, very privileged indeed to have Professor Evan Moghlan speaking to us this evening. The last time he spoke in Edinburgh, at our annual lecture a couple of years ago, it was to mark the launch of the GPL3. Well, we haven't got anything quite so headline-grabbing this evening, but we have something which I think is going to be very much an issue in the years to come. Because the days when computers were merely just things which sat on your desktop have long since disappeared. The true nature of a computer is that a computer is in everything. Software is in everything. And when software is in everything, well, what are the future nightmare liabilities and how can they be avoided? That is the theme of Evan's talk this evening. I don't think I need to say very much to you about Professor Moghlan, who is very, very well known throughout the world, but for those of you who maybe aren't familiar with him, he had in his earlier career the distinction of clerking for Justice Thurgood Marshall of the United States Supreme Court, and he has taught at Columbia Law School, and he holds visiting appointments at Harvard University, Tel Aviv University, and the University of Virginia. He is the founder of the free software. Software Freedom Law Center. Yeah. The Software Freedom Law Center. And he has achieved the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Pioneer Award for efforts on behalf of freedom in the electronic society. He's admitted to practice in the state of New York and before the United States Supreme Court. So, man, and of course, you know him all from his extremely extensive writing and lecturing. So would you please join with me and welcome Professor Moghlan.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks so much. It's an honor and a really very great pleasure to be here again among friends. When I was last here, as Ian mentioned, I was coming to the end of a long and complicated process of negotiating one particular matter of licensing free software. And I spoke here partly out of desperation and partly out of hope. I was desperate to begin thinking about something else after 16 months of the GPL all the time, and I was hopeful that we had done the job in a way which, although nobody was more conscious than I of the difficulties, the bumps, and the primitiveness of our collaboration, might signal something good about the future. I speak here today, I suppose, out of hope and desperation, which feels very different to me. I'm concerned because one of the things I have been thinking about recently is the difficulty that we face when software is in everything, based on a little bit of the experience I have going around the world looking at all the places software is. I speak out of hope because I do think it is possible that if we understand what is happening a little bit quicker than we usually do about large-scale social change, we will avoid a lot of nastiness that's otherwise going to be pretty serious for us. So the place I want to start then is with the definition of a problem. The problem that I would like to define, I did try and put in the title, but everything is, of course, a remarkably indistinct word. So let me begin where I think the moment tells us to begin, by pointing out that software is in cars. Software is in medical devices. Software is in all other forms of vehicular transport. And software is now and increasingly will be more and more fully represented in buildings themselves, that is, the fundamental constituents of the built environment where we dwell and where we work and where we take care of one another. These aspects of software's being in everything, then, though they are merely reflective of everything, I don't mean that that's the exclusive list of everything, but let us just, because I don't mean to talk all evening, talk about them as though they were enough of everything to make the point. And let's begin then with a few, what shall I say, speculations, not facts, which would take too long and require too much like proof. And all of us here will understand that when matters of large liability are at stake, proof is not a thing you can do lightly. One of the things that we know this year in 2010, and I'm going to stick to matters about now, one of the things we know about now is that sometimes cars mysteriously speed up and crash into things. That's not a disputed statement, that why they mysteriously speed up and crash into things raises all the usual kinds of difficulties of causation and proof that you would expect when liability is a serious social matter. But let's just say that we know that cars mysteriously speed up and crash into things, and it's reasonable to wonder about software in relation to the cause of those accidents. And wondering about whether there is software behind some of those accidents raises some important questions. There is software in the things that power people's hearts, and it fails sometimes. That, too, is a fact. There's a lot more to be said, and once again, proof is an important subject, and I don't mean to do more than speculate. The rules about what software you can put in medical devices and how you test are not rules which would be regarded as sufficient to create safety in other industries whose liability profile is substantially lower than medical devices. My organization, the Software Freedom Law Center, will next month be publishing a report on this particular subject, and so I'm going to limit myself to speculations here in knowledge that some facts will become publicly available shortly that will be illuminating. Software flies airplanes, and sometimes software fails, perhaps creating accidents. Once again, that's the most that one could say without entering into a complicated discussion. But I think it would be useful to indicate the nature of the subject there a little more precisely. So let us give it an airline and a flight number, Air France 447, which went down in the Atlantic Ocean on the 1st of June 2009, killing 228 people. Today, 13 months after that accident, the flight data recorders have not been discovered. The problem has been posed by one crash investigator as locating an object the size of a shoebox in an area the size of Paris, 3,000 meters below the surface of the ocean, in terrain as rugged as the Alps. There is every reason to believe that those flight data recorders, which have not been discovered in the last 13 months, will never be discovered. And the only direct information available about the cause of the loss of Air France 447 will be the automated telemetry received from the plane in the last hour of its flight in thunderstorm activity over the central South Atlantic. The telemetry shows that the aircraft experienced the loss of trust in one of its inertial navigation guidance systems. It is hypothesized that that may have occurred due to icing of a tube on the outside face of the plane, which registers air pressure changes for inertial guidance input. We know that one of the two redundant inertial guidance systems had failed in the opinion of the software that determines whether or not to trust the system, and that the standby air data system and the other inertial guidance inputs were disagreeing. Thus, there was a disagreement between the two available sources of information, and one had been ruled unreliable and not to be consulted. And in that condition, the next thing registered was vertical falling of the passenger cabin, which led to, we infer, powered flight into ground. In other words, the only thing we are ever likely to know about Air France 447 is that there was a multiple condition software failure in process on the airplane, after which it was lost. So what I am talking about then is the inevitable occurrence of what we would regard as significant liability issues surrounding software failure as among the significant causal possibilities throughout society. That's the definition of the problem. The parties affected by the problem, in addition to the human beings killed, injured, or otherwise subjected to losses for which liability may rest with someone else, are manufacturers and regulators around the world who face serious issues about operation at the edge of their ability to foresee. Manufacturers face, obviously, the problem of constructing devices which meet both regulatory demands and market conditions, in which we may treat the avoidance of avoidable liabilities as among their regulatory demands. But they experience some secondary difficulties from time to time with relation to the software they embed in the products that they make, whose failure may cause harm. One of the difficulties that they experience is that they acquire software from third parties with indemnities or liability exclusions, which are extremely limited for them as purchasers. A more serious problem is sometimes they do not acquire software legitimately. One of the difficulties one can speculate would be faced by an automobile manufacturer who learned that some of its fundamental control software is causing harm. One of the difficulties one might speculate, I at least would on the basis of my experience, is that the manufacturer might not be in a position to disclose about its software all of the matters one would expect them to know, like how they got it. Because there is a lot of software in the world doing jobs that we might think of as quite legally important with respect to the possible incurring of liability by the manufacturer, which was acquired through means that we would characterize as informal, if we were being exculpatory. And if you're in a situation where you have software which you reasonably believe is malfunctioning and which you might even be able to fix, but which has already caused very substantial harm, in your opinion, The last thing you would want to have to do is come forward and confess a sin in its acquisition, because that would lead to problems that you can't control very easily. And therefore, it is much simpler to fall back upon the difficulty of proving that software had anything to do with it. Now, in the case of automobiles, it is particularly easy, and in the case of aircraft crashes, it is particularly hard to suggest what the manufacturer mostly wants to be able to suggest in a situation like that, which is that the person operating the product probably caused the harm. The aircraft passenger is among the most passively vulnerable forms of modern human experience. As we are made to remember every single time we go to the airport and somebody prods us as though we were criminals, our vulnerability, at least if you travel as much as I do, is always reinforced to you by the behavior authority deals out to you in international air transport. But once you are belted in, if computers on the airplane begin to disagree about what information should be presented to the expert human beings who are supposed to make the judgments, who have the fate of the aircraft, the passengers, and the crew in their hands, will be something you can do nothing whatever about. And if the computers disagree and the pilots don't get to make expert judgments and the airplane falls out of the sky, which could conceivably have happened once already, at least, then obviously it will be very difficult for the manufacturer of the airplane to say that the passenger was in any way at fault, and he will limit himself to saying that the airline didn't do with the airplane as it should. He will also fix anything that's wrong with the software. Which is why, oddly enough, the aircraft isn't our biggest problem, and I didn't put it in the headline. The automobile, on the other hand, is a very dangerous machine whose tendency to cause harm can always be blamed on the driver. And I will simply limit myself to pointing out to you that Toyota has had, for many years, both as expert witnesses and as consultants, a number of social psychologists with distinguished appointments at American universities on the payroll in order to testify in lawsuits that people often press the accelerator pedal under the mistaken impression that they are pressing the brake, particularly under conditions of stress. This is one of those beautiful counterintuitive results of social psychology, teaching you something about human beings which you are able then to marvel at because it is a property of human beings which is apparently universal but which has never happened to you in your own life. Where I wager with great certainty that you have never actually pressed the accelerator pedal, accelerated down the highway and crashed into something under the impression that you were holding your foot on the brake. This is what you do when software malfunctions, sometimes, I would suggest. And lawyers make money doing it, and things that lawyers make money doing are unlikely to stop happening unless forced. Regulators then have two problems. First, they must have jurisdiction to regulate, and second, they must have competence. Jurisdiction to regulate is not merely a formal question, it's a practical one. Japanese administrative agencies have authority in the jurisdictional sense to regulate automobile safety, but it is famously the case that automobile safety in Japan is a self-regulatory matter, as internet privacy is in the United States. A subject I'm not going to talk about today, but which would justify another visit to Edinburgh if you're ever inclined to invite me back. Regulated jurisdiction, in other words, over software in particular, would mean regulators deciding to go into businesses they have largely left, each in their own way, to be adjusted by other people. If one could say only the best of regulatory conduct in this area, one would say that it had resulted in a lot of self-regulation. That's the good news. One of the other problems, I won't get to the whole of the bad news all at once because I wish to emphasize hope over desperation at least to some extent. One of the bad things about regulation, then, is the extraordinary difficulty that regulators have maintaining competence to cover this portion of their jurisdiction practically. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in the United States, our chief automobile safety regulator, an agency which is comparatively active, extremely thorough, and from a technical point of view very well informed, but which often loses battles over recalls due to the politics of regulation in the United States. NHTSA, an organization which rarely has the difficulty of getting its facts right, was compelled to admit in the course of the discussions about Toyota's automobiles in the United States this spring that it had no engineers capable of providing independent testing of Toyota's relevant software in its relevant models of automobile. No capable engineers. Because this is an area so far outside the practical jurisdiction of even a quite conscientious regulator. And so NHTSA has borrowed 50 software engineers from NASA in order to thicken its ability to conduct a meaningful investigation in this instance, which says nothing about how a continuing presence in this area would be managed if facts happened to justify the desire to look into the software in cars more thoroughly than has been done in the past. Similarly, I'm not going to restrict myself to beating up on North American regulators in this talk, and I'm not going to restrict myself by any means to beating up on regulators, but similarly to offer another U.S. example, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States, which, modulo again its difficulties in the politics of regulation, is also a highly factually competent agency with a comparatively deep technical understanding of its subject. The FDA long ago outsourced to private commercial parties the job of testing the safety of medical devices under a devolution of government into the private sector activity that I could call by some name that would be familiar to you, but which might sound, you know, deprecatory. At any rate, what has happened is that those organizations contract to test the safety of medical devices, and as we shall report next month, the protocols concerning how they test software for those purposes, which are contractual in nature and which are therefore documented, the protocols they use would not be sufficient for testing software in a matter far less important than a pacemaker or an insulin pump. Once again, the fundamental difficulty will turn out to be that testing software is a complex activity. And simple testing of software, asserting that it manages under conditions of single cause of failure situations, is inadequate, even if the software cannot, in its malfunction, cause imminent death, as some of this software can and perhaps has. So once again, what we shall discover is that regulatory authorities face significant constraints on their cognitive capacity and on their ability to conduct the kind of testing, even if it is only sporadic spot testing, which we assume assures the safety and quality of materials used in society where harm imminently results from failure. In the hotel in which I am staying here, a lovely establishment, but which I shan't name for reasons that will be apparent in a moment, there was an accident last week in which an elevator cable parted and an elevator containing guests in the hotel plummeted from the second story into the basement. When you check in at the hotel, you merely see a sign that says, we're sorry that this elevator isn't working and we're apologetic about any inconvenience it may cause. I know that the accident occurred because a gentleman I met in the course of my journey from New York to Edinburgh earlier this week was the employer of the two people who were in the car. And in casual conversation waiting for a delayed airplane, the matter came out. I haven't, I admit, looked into the question of elevator safety regulation in the municipality. But in every city in the world where buildings are tall, and they've been tall here in proportion to the environment for longer than they have in most parts of the world, elevator safety is a regulated matter, and there are periodic inspections, and people who are independent engineers, working at least in theory for the common good, are supposed to conduct such tests as will allow them to predict statistically that there is a very low likelihood of a fatal accident until the next regular inspection. With most of the software that causes harm if it fails in the world, there is no regular inspection. There is no requirement to make the materials inspectable. And there is great doubt about the capacity of regulators and the technicians they can reasonably expect to employ within budgetary constraints to conduct the kind of investigation to assure safety which is characteristic of the simple physical stuff out of which the dangerous parts of our world are built. That's the full explication of why we're going to have liability nightmares. I recognize that there may be people in the room for whom the phrase liability nightmare sounds like a good thing. And this is part of why I speak out of desperation. Because oddly enough, there are a lot of smart people on the other side of what I'm about to say. Some of those people have business interests in being allowed to determine the quantum of this risk all by themselves and to lay it off as silently as possible. Because, of course, there are pathologies of private governance, just as there are pathologies of public governance. Oddly enough, under late capitalism, when financial industries are strong, businesses' incentives to study and prevent the risks of catastrophic loss can be remarkably low. The reason those incentives can be so low is that the avoidance of catastrophic but low probability risks with real costs in the present looks like expenses you can cut. And if you are leveraging your business, avoidance of catastrophic risks of low probability with substantial present costs in either time or money will cause failures to go underprevented routinely as a result of the gravity of the balance sheet. Allow me to mention in this context Lord Brown, whose creation of the, don't call it, British Petroleum Company, as we know it now, for a short while more, resulted from the leveraged acquisition of large numbers of oil companies building an immensity, which then had to save money everywhere it could in order to manage the expenses against which it had to balance the costs of the immense leverage that had created it. That BP became well understood throughout the world as a safety miser. And its record in every major jurisdiction where it functioned showed that its incentives had become to underinsure against low-frequency catastrophic risk because the avoidance of present expense was irrevocably determined by the gravity of the balance sheet. We had a refinery explosion in the United States. We had significant pipeline injury resulting from inadequate management in the United States. And now, I say no more. So I am desperate because there are forces at work in all the places where justice must be made, that is, among the public regulators, within the private businesses, and even at the bar. There are forces that do not want to hear what I am going to say, which is that we can't live this way. This must not happen. This is another form of ecological harm resulting from our inability to understand the technological nature of our transformation of society shrewdly and rapidly enough to avoid serious human harms. I said recently, I will admit, that Mr. Zuckerberg had done more harm to the human race than anybody else his age. And that's an unfortunate fact about where we live now. But I need to point out to you that there are a lot of people in the world a lot older than Mr. Zuckerman. Now, we've got a problem we must fix. And the bad news, as I have pointed out, is that we are not socially aligned even to recognize it, let alone to fix it. The hopeful part of my talk is unfortunately rather short, but it's rather intense. Because the good news is, freedom foresaw the problem, and we could fix it if we were let. You see, the fundamental difficulty is a difficulty which arises from the inadequacy of regimes of inspection. Manufacturers have incentives for non-transparency, including non-transparent ways of creating the code they put in things. Regulators have an incentive for transparency, but they cannot manage the expensive cognitive machinery necessary to understand and to repair the liabilities created by software. And legal rules, though of course productive of an exacting and thorough sort of justice, as we all know, are at their very best effective in certain forms of post-harm redistribution, against which I have nothing bad to say except that they don't prevent the nightmare. All they do is, after long litigation, move money around between insurers, which is not really a sufficient response. We do possess the answers necessary to implement a different way of thinking about things in the free world. First of all, we produce transparently. Second, we avail ourselves of what has come to be known in the free world as Linus's Law, named after Linus Torvalds, that in the presence of enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. This is not necessarily a correct technical statement, but it is, in this context, an important social proposition. The correct way to maximize the available inspection of software that can fail is to use civil society's full width to conduct inspection. I don't need to explain to you what can be accomplished in this world by a single motivated hacker. I don't need to explain to you why it is that if you tell everybody on Earth the software that could fail, killing your mother the next time she takes an airplane, is on the web, you might want to have a look at it. There is a remarkably high number of very talented and thoughtful people around the world who will do exactly that. So what I'm going to say oddly enough, reduces to a couple of rather simple principles, which could avoid a great deal of liability nightmare around the world. On the downside, some lawyers would get less rich doing those liability nightmares, and I acknowledge in an audience such as this the legitimacy of that consideration, but the upside is more substantial. We would actually avoid a lot of deaths. Proprietary software is an unsafe building material. You can't inspect it. You can't assess its complex failure modes easily by simply poking at the finished article. And most important of all, if you were aware of a problem that was of a safety-enhancing kind that you could fix, you couldn't fix it. If you were aware of a catastrophic failure mode, you couldn't do anything about it, except ask the manufacturer to fix it, who, of course, sells almost all the software that it sells, if it sells to consumers, under shrink wrap with a Hadley against Baxendaleization of the whole thing, which basically says, if the software fails catastrophically and obliterates your town, we'll give you your money back. So proprietary software is an unsafe building material. We shouldn't use it for purposes that could conceivably cause harm, like running personal computers. Let alone should we use it for things like anti-lock brakes or throttle control in automobiles. We wouldn't allow people to build black box elevators, you know? They've got to be inspectable, and they have to be repairable by the people in whose buildings they are. That's a sensible rule. Arrived at over a long period of experience with what can happen when things fall, which you would expect us to carry unchanged into our experience of the digital environment, but which is not. The basic principle of the difficulty that we face is we can't see enough and we can't modify it fast enough to avoid merely assessing in an extraordinarily complex way that the legal system too will be no good at what went wrong after it fails. What we actually need is the ability to harness civil society to prevent failure. This is a problem, in other words, which can be prevented more easily than it can be coped with after the fact. The obscurity of my principle, the fact that it hasn't been widely endorsed throughout the world, well, I will leave the question why everybody hasn't seen it already to be discussed by others. Because after all, I really am, however desperately, an optimist. I actually think what we ought to do is just recognize the truth of this and fix it. I can't imagine that there's anybody who wouldn't want to, unless they had existing incentives already not to want to. And so what we have is a democracy problem, because that's how we deal with things like this. In other words, we need regulation, but the regulation that we need is regulation that prevents harm. A not difficult proposition usually to offer to a legislator. We need to use inspectable and testable building materials in constructing the artifacts that run our lives. Well, that's not a terribly difficult proposition to put before a legislature. Every legislature in the 20th century accepted that to great extent, from the municipalities around us to the national governments and beyond. The European Commission prohibits flatly the use of user-modifiable software in medical devices. The European Commission's view is that the presence of modifiable software in medical devices causes risk. I perfectly understand this point of view, but it's precisely backward. on the whole, over the entirety of the problem, the availability of software you can read, understand, and repair, which can be vetted thoroughly, which can be fully disclosed to civil society, which can be assured to work, though in which who installs modifications in which devices can be rigidly controlled by many forms of law, including criminal law, makes sense. The determination that every medical device will be a black box, fully testable only by its manufacturer, does not make sense. The existing compromises, including the European Commission's view, are unfortunately not working. In the United States, at least in theory, regulation makes more room for the possibility of free software in medical devices. But practice is, of course, very much the other way. I will state, as grounded speculation resulting from my experience, that there is at least one major manufacturer in Europe who is out of compliance with GPL concerning GPL software embedded in the medical devices they sell here, because they believe that it is less risky to disobey the GPL and risk copyright infringement lawsuits than to risk the wrath of the European Commission for using that GPL software in medical devices. If you're a large manufacturer of medical devices in Europe and that's the choice your regulatory masters put you to, that would be a bad thing. I say, happening to believe that violating GPL is a bad idea for practical as well as moral reasons. But what we really benefit from is the recognition that the more brains we harness to the process of making this extraordinarily complex and failure-prone technological environment around us safe, the better we will do. Failures in software that cause security problems are not the biggest difficulty. They're overemphasized by several orders of magnitude. But they're not trivial, and I would be remiss if I didn't say something about them, which is that they offer an excellent demonstration of why it's better to have more eyeballs on the code. I appreciate that there is a strong controversy around the world over whether proprietary operating systems or free operating systems are more secure. But you appreciate that that controversy is like the controversy over whether people sometimes press the accelerator when they meant to press the brake and keep it there long enough to drive down the highway and crash into things, because you have more Windows computers in your life in all likelihood than I have in mine. And so you know. What we really recognize ourselves is also recognized by the regulators, and to some extent it's recognized by the manufacturers. Though they adopt our software primarily because it's cheap for them, they also know it works. And works includes doesn't send their devices up in smoke and other such things, which are, after all, not good for you, and which they wish to avoid. If they didn't believe they were avoiding those risks, which are catastrophic to them, if not to the human beings around them, they wouldn't use our stuff. Even the lawyers know this would be a good idea, because I've told you, and although I'm happy to answer hostile questions if anybody has any, the truth is this is common sense, really. And despite predictions on the subject by non-lawyers, lawyers listen to common sense. So we're going to have to do it. We're going to have to do it. It's going to take some trouble to get it done, because there are going to be a lot of people on the other side for reasons we've just investigated. And each one of the catastrophes that ought to be the last straw, there's going to be argument about. There's going to be discussion about causation and proof, and it's going to be immensely complicated. And some of the people in this room will be adding smoke, because that's their job, and they do it well. So it's not going to work the way it ought to work, namely, look, we got to do something about that. Unless people are willing to synthesize the data for themselves and put it together and add common sense to it and make a democratic demand, it won't occur. And a lot of other things will occur that we will feel bad about, that we should have avoided, that I just told you we could raise our odds of avoiding very drastically, and all we have to do is be for freedom, which is surely the most desperate kind of hope anybody could have offered under these circumstances. Thank you very much.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. Don't tell anyone I'm free. Don't tell anyone I'm free.
See, now we're really the BSD podcast because you're singing the music from it. Do you want to change our music?
No.
The BSD music? Okay.
You're not changing the music.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay. I didn't want to change the music. You're just singing it.